This is Daniel Cobb, Doctor of Oriental Medicine, and welcome to my show, Natural Medicine. I've been in the past a computer programmer. I've become a Doctor of Oriental Medicine about 11 years ago. I've written articles for national holistic healthcare journals. And for the past 4 years, I've been teaching anatomy and physiology at various professional schools around Santa Fe and Albuquerque. My contact phone number at my clinic, in case you want to contact me, is 424-9527. That's area code 505. And in case you want to call into the show, the number here is 505-424-4550. This morning, we're going to be talking about breast cancer. And, of course, I've been thinking about doing the show for several weeks. And, of course, I'm going to be taking a very holistic and nutritional approach towards this, which may cast, in some ways, some unfavorable light on the Susan G. Komen Foundation and the American Cancer Society's approach. So I thought, oh, it would only be fair to invite someone to represent the more conventional approach toward this. So I did make contact with the Susan G. Komen for the Cure of Central New Mexico location in Albuquerque, and did talk to the director there, Susan Simons. And she was initially enthusiastic about picking out one of her staff to represent them on the show. But then over the course of a couple days, decided against it. So she declined without any further explanation. So I'll just go ahead and do the show. But at least I wanted you to know I tried to have an opposing viewpoint on the show. So one of the things that I have done for years, probably 6, 8, 10 years, where I routinely teach little classes on how to, how to prevent disease. And so one of the classes I teach is actually on breast cancer. And because I'm very nutritionally oriented, I go through and try to find the best nutrients to prevent breast cancer. Now, these are also, they're not limited to breast cancer. I'm going to present this in terms of breast cancer, but for instance, the number one nutrient is probably iodine. iodine supplementation is probably not terribly well known, not terribly well connected with breast cancer. But there are actually a few websites out there that have made, that really understand the connection. And let me quote the sort of the lead statement from one of those sites. It says, what if there was one nutrient which, one, desensitized estrogen receptors in the breast, two, reduced estrogen production in overactive ovaries, three, reduced fibrocystic breast disease, which often precedes breast cancer, four, caused cancer cell death, slowed down cell division, and reduced blood vessel growth to tumors. Five, caused more cell death than the chemo drug, Fluorouracil. Six, prevented rats from getting cancer when they were fed the breast cancer-causing toxin, DMBA. Well, of course, if any drug company had a drug that can do these things, they would be jumping up and down for joy at the prospects of making, tens of billions of dollars a year in profit. But what they're describing, of course, is the effects of iodine in terms of the prevention and the treatment of breast cancer. One of the last statement, prevented rats from getting cancer when they were fed the breast cancer-causing toxin DMBA, actually relates to a study that was done with rats, and they were the breast tissue levels of iodine were optimized, and then cancer tumors were implanted in the breast tissue, and the cancers all died. So the researchers thought, oh, they must have messed up the study, so they redid it. The cancers all died. So then they said, well, I guess we better have a control group. And then in the rats with the optimized level of iodine, the cancers all died. But in the control group, they got approximately 50% deaths from cancers. And so the conclusion from the study was, in rats, if you get the iodine levels in the breast tissue optimized, you cannot grow cancer cells. Okay. How well does this apply to humans? Well, there's plenty of evidence that it does apply to humans. And iodine, and I think therefore iodine really needs to be viewed as probably the top nutrient.
That would also explain why Japan has a lower incident, right?
Right. Historically, Japan has had a high level of sea vegetables and fish in the diet. Now, with the recent Fukushima thing, there's probably going to be some changes in the long-term cancer rates there. But historically, people in Japan were getting approximately 12 milligrams per day of iodine, and their breast cancer rates were very, very low. Now, you'd think, well, maybe, you know, genetically the Japanese are less prone to breast cancer. But really, that's not true, because when the Japanese move to, let's say, Western countries, and after they've been here for a generation, the rates of breast cancer gradually gravitate toward the rate of, let's say, if they move to America, they gravitate toward the rate of breast cancer in America. Hmm. So the protective thing goes away if they go away from their country. Does it go away because they quit eating the level of fish and level of sea vegetables? Probably. Over time, they start adopting a more conventional American diet, or whatever for whatever country they're going to, and their levels of breast cancer also move in the same direction. The next nutrient that's really important for breast cancer is vitamin D. And vitamin D is generally very protective against cancers of a variety of kinds and improves the immune function in a variety of ways. But the sentence has been written and uttered that if everyone's level of vitamin D could be optimized, that the writer believed that breast cancer would be virtually eradicated. Now, my opinion is that's a little bit of an overreach, but there are plenty of other studies that indicate that when vitamin D levels are optimized, that the incidence of breast cancer drops between 50 and 70%. and the third nutrient that I pay a lot of attention to is selenium. And selenium is excellent for to prevent viral infections, but also for cancer. And the important thing about these three nutrients is that they're very inexpensive. You can get reasonable dosages of these three nutrients and priced out at retail levels from a Santa Fe health food store. You can get these for approximately 20 cents a day. And so we're talking, you know, to do a fairly reasonable, you know, not an excellent, but a fairly reasonable job of prevention over the course of a year, it might cost you $70. If you add vitamin C, vitamin E, and zinc, which are more expensive, your cost might go up to $1 a day or $350 to $60 a year. But still very, very inexpensive in terms of preventative function.
How about from the foods that you eat? Can you get enough selenium just from
you can,
the
but
soil?
You really have to be a good absorber. You have to have a very good digestive tract, and you have to like things such as, let's say, Brazil nuts. And vitamin D, if you get a lot of sunlight, if you're a gardener, if you do outside things, and like fish, you might get enough vitamin D. The iodine is difficult. And I think right now we're probably going to head for a break. We'll be back. This is Daniel Cobb, Doctor of Oriental Medicine. Welcome back to my radio show, Natural Medicine. I'm here in the studio with my wife, Karen. And just a few more notes about iodine is up until about the 1980s, iodine was used as a bread conditioner in all commercial bread. Therefore, the population as a whole, especially whenever they ate commercial bread, which was probably fairly frequently, we're getting about 100 micrograms, 125 micrograms of iodine per slice of bread. Around about that time, because the RDA was about 150 micrograms, somebody from the FDA said, oh my gosh, what about those people that eat a lot of bread? They might be getting big overdoses of iodine, which I view as an absurd statement. Because, for instance, I routinely take between 9 and 12 milligrams of iodine per day as Lugol solution. And so that would be getting close to 100 slices of bread, with the way that it was dosed in the 1980s. And
well, what are the symptoms if you get too much?
It's actually pretty hard to overdose on iodine, but the first symptom at lower levels of overdose is that you might be hungry but not inclined, not have an appetite, not want to eat. But iodine is one of the things that's probably the hardest mineral to overdose on. And so at the levels that the government was being worried about, it was really actually absurd. But then they changed. They said, okay, now you can't put iodine, you can't use iodine as a dough conditioner. And so they started using bromide instead of, or bromine instead of iodine. And which caused two things. It caused people to start getting deficient in iodine because they weren't getting the iodine from the bread. But also, bromine competes for sites in the body with iodine, so that when bromine gets there first, iodine isn't necessarily going to get to the proper spot in your body, especially in the thyroid. So we started seeing all kinds of iodine deficiency problems as a result of a bread decision by the FDA in the 1980s. Let's shift the view here to the more conventional approach towards breast cancer. So we're looking for the American Cancer Society, but more specifically the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation. And Karen, why don't you tell us your initial, your reaction to the Susan G. Komen Foundation?
Well, I always think, why are we racing for the cure? Why don't we ever race for the cause? I mean, it's pretty clear when you read the research, they do know what things cause or contribute to breast cancer, but you never hear anybody ever talk about that. It's always aimed at treatment, and it's always aimed at drugs and chemotherapy and, all the really invasive things, mastectomies. We just had that in the news recently with Angelina Jolie making that very radical decision. But, I just always wonder, why is it always that way? Why is it always these treatment things? And I almost feel guilty that I'm just sort of get a negative reaction anymore when I see everything pink. Like even at the bank, I noticed that the carrier that comes out in the teller has a little pink cap. So evidently, everybody, I feel like I must be really bizarre, because I'm just not really getting on board with this whole this pink thing?
Well, in many times, in especially, you know, in the industrialized countries, when things don't seem to make sense, you have to put it against the backdrop of follow the money. And if you follow the money on a preventative treatment for breast cancer that costs 20 cents a day, that money trail doesn't, that's not very deep, and it doesn't get followed very much.
Well, you mentioned one time something about pink washing.
Yes, it's, well, sometimes, let's say there's certain companies that produce chemicals that may lead to cancers of variety of type, including breast cancer. Let's say pesticides, herbicides. But if they get on board with the Susan G. Komen Foundation and they get the authorization to use the pink ribbon and to give people that are buying their products the warm and fuzzy feeling that they're helping to cure breast cancer, to resolve this issue, et cetera, that it sometimes camouflages the effect of what they're selling. So, it's a very effective, public relations campaign.
Well, politicians do it a lot too, I think, to get women to vote for them. It sounds like, oh, well, this politician really cares about cancer research, so therefore, you know, I'll vote for this person.
And you look at what I would call the cancer industry, and you say, where does the money come from? Okay, where is the money spent? If you want to cure breast cancer, the averages from different sources are somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 per case. Like I said, if you want to prevent it, it costs way, way less than that. But also the screening is an important part of the breast cancer industry. Mammograms are huge in a long-term sense.
You know, a few years ago, I don't know if you remember, but they were cutting down the recommendation. There was a government recommendation that, women should only go every 2 years. Women over 50 should only go every 2 years instead of every year. And there was a huge outcry. And a lot of it was even by feminists who thought it was some sort of an anti-woman thing. So, I mean, the message has really gotten out there that...
Right.
That mammograms are, you know, this wonderful thing that we all need to be getting all the time.
But now let's dig a little deeper into the mammograms. Now, when we talk about, let's say, Fukushima, we know that people are getting cancer and dying from radiation exposure. And we also know that if you're exposed to too much radiation, one of the effects is to get cancer. So why are we not putting those two together and saying, do mammograms cause cancer? Does the radiation contribute in the long-term sense to cancer?
Well, one place that is real clear is, men and breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what contributes to a man getting breast cancer. And one of the things that it says in all the literature and all the websites is exposure to radiation. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow exposure to radiation is how you're supposed to find the cancer. I mean, it's just not logical.
Well, in some ways it can be a little bit logical, but they need to own up to both sides of this equation. Decades ago, there was an MD named John Goffman who was engaged by the government to research the effects of radiation. And he did a lot of different studies. One of his most famous studies was epidemiological. He would look at what happens in areas where there were very, very few doctors. And then as doctors came into that area in larger numbers, then he would look at what changes were affected, and certain infections rates would go down, and we'd say, okay, doctors are good at preventing or treating that infection. But one of the things that he noticed was that cancer rates would go up. So his conclusion was, okay, whatever it is that the body of doctors are doing is actually contributing to cancer rather than preventing it. And his concluding statement on breast cancer is that medical radiation causes 75% of all breast cancers. Now, that doesn't mean that mammograms cause 75%. Mammograms are medical radiation, but, you know, a chest x-ray, a dental x-ray, this is all an accumulation of a lifetime of medical radiation. He's saying the sum of all the accumulated medical radiation is causing 75% of all breast cancers. And
if you add into that all the other exposures that we get, you know, just what, like microwaves, standing close to a microwave, traveling in the air, going through the scanners at the airports. There's probably a lot of other things, right?
And I do want to add about John Goffman is that I've read a lot of his stuff. I've read about his thing, about his articles, about his report, and I've never run across anyone that says, "Oh no, his study's no good because of this statistical anomaly or it's flawed." I've never read something that was that critiques it that says, "Yeah, his research is no good." What I have noticed is that it's ignored. And whereas we are bombarded with the ideas of, oh, mammograms, you know, prevent, you know, catch cancers early, and they, you know, early detection equals more survivability. But I've, you know, almost never, unless you go digging for it, do you find any reference to John Goffman's study on medical radiation. And now we're going to head off to another break, and we'll be back with more on breast cancer. And this is Daniel Cobb, doctor of ornamental medicine, back with my radio show, Natural Medicine, here in the studio with my wife, Karen. And Karen, we were halfway through mammograms.
Oh yeah, and I just wanted to point out there's a really good article. If anybody out there is, you know, actively dealing with this issue, or if you want to learn more about it, there's a new magazine that's been showing up at the health food stores. It's What Doctors Don't Tell You. It's out of the UK, and in the June issue, it has a whole section on heart disease, and one of the things, on breast cancer, and one of the things that it talks about in there is the American Cancer Society, and it points out that that there have been 5 different presidents of the American Cancer Society, and they've all been radiologists. So there is definitely a strong bend in the American Cancer Society to lead toward mammography. And, you know, in the UK, it's not quite as widespread to treat breast cancer the way it is here, right?
Well, it's close, yeah.
But it also mentions in this article, it says that just as good a treatment, and in fact a better treatment or a better diagnostic, a way to diagnose it, would be through thermography.
Yeah, thermography is totally non-invasive. It doesn't use radiation at all. It just maps, and it doesn't distort the breast. And physically, there's no squeezing, pushing. And it just makes a map of the heat signature of the breast tissues. And, of course, when there's cancer, you're going to have more heat because there's a lot more cell division going on. And, you know, I've read about thermography. It seems like you can catch cancer at an earlier stage there, although some of the some of the articles say, oh, you should confirm this with mammography. But I can think of a lot of reasons not to confirm it with mammography.
So if you didn't want to completely, just not do any diagnostic, if you felt like, okay, I don't feel comfortable with a mammogram, could you ask your doctor for this?
Yes, you can.
And is it available here?
It is available. I know it's available in Albuquerque. I think it's available in Santa Fe. But typically, it's not paid for by insurance.
Oh, well, that's a big problem.
Yeah. But it is definitely safer.
Well, you know, I had heard one time, and I don't know if this is true or not, but the form of breast cancer that's where the tumor is encapsulated, that actually getting the mammogram where your breasts are really squished, I mean, it's very painful. I don't think men quite realize what women go through with this. It's a very uncomfortable procedure. But that pressure can actually break open that encapsulated cancer, and then it's free to spread. Is that?
Exactly right. Yeah. And there's one of your body's techniques for dealing with diseased tissue, whether it's tuberculosis, cancer, small cancer tumors, is to encapsulate it, to surround it with a highly fibrous capsule. And once it's effectively encapsulated, it's just not going anywhere. But if you break open the capsule, now it's free to roam once again. And so, yes, this is an additional risk factor for mammography, so that you could accurately say that mammograms cause breast cancer two ways.
The two ways?
Well, the first, the accumulation of, you know, the lifetime exposure to medical radiation, increasing that, and breaking open encapsulated cancers. Now, one of the next ideas that we want to present is, you know, there's flowery descriptions of the science of breast cancer is increasing, we're finding things earlier, we're getting, the cure rate is skyrocketing. But there are some reasons to be suspicious about what people, you know, what various sources present as the cure rate. Because there is a subset of breast cancer called, say, DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. Now, in situ should be a clue for a lot of those scientists.
What is that word?
In situ. It means it's in place, which pretty much means it's not going anywhere. It's not an invasive cancer.
So it's not something that grows. It's just something that exists?
It's something that is viewed as being a precursor to real cancer, but it is not a real cancer. But in many cases, once the diagnosis of DCIS is made, the DCIS is treated as if it were a real cancer, whereas in most cases, probably in only in 30-35% of the cases, does it progress. Would it, if it were just left alone, would it progress to a real invasive cancer? And so let's look at the effect, not only that many women are being treated pointlessly for a DCIS that would never become a cancer, but also look at the statistical effects of treating DCIS, and then when it doesn't progress to cancer, then they get to claim a cancer cure. And this results in highly inflated cancer cure rates. There's also a different category of a thing that affects and inflates cancer cure rates, because in the past couple of decades, the ability to find cancers and find breast cancers at a very early stage has increased dramatically.
Is it true that this article that I was referencing, It says that mammograms can't pick up the fast-growing tumors. Is that true?
Well, they may have some difficulty.
So the ones that are actually the most dangerous are the ones maybe that they're least likely to identify, or no?
There's all kinds of problems with false negatives and false positives with mammograms, and that's one of them.
Yeah, the other thing it says is that mammograms see 10 cancers that aren't actually there for every genuine case they detect. So 10 to 1, that's pretty extreme considering all the worry and all the stress.
Right. When you get a false positive, a woman begins the process of being treated for cancer until between her oncologist, herself, et cetera, they discover that, oh, oops, it wasn't actually a cancer. So then the treatment would stop. And whatever emotional worry, financial expense, physical damage is incurred from the, up to that point is all one of the negative factors about various diagnostic techniques. But now let's go back to the idea that if you have diagnostic techniques that can find cancers very, very early, then in some cases you'll be finding cancers that are so small that and this has been found to be the case in more than one study epidemiologically, that if you just left that tumor alone, the body's own immune system would have overcome it, and it would never have developed into a more serious breast cancer.
So this DCIS is a good example of that?
Not exactly, because that's arguably maybe not even a cancer, right? But there are some real cancers that are found at very early stages, early enough that they're very small, that they may be overcome by the body's own immune system, so that if they were not treated, they would have never developed into a more serious cancer. Now, what this does is it once again becomes a second factor for the distortion of the cure rate. And I want to make a distinction between the rate of cure and the mortality rate, because they're dramatically different ideas. The mortality rate is how many people per 100,000 die from this condition, okay, in a given time frame. And the cure rate is how many people that got this disease then were later cured from this disease. And this is important because let's say a woman gets a diagnosis of breast cancer. Let's say they get a diagnosis of DCIS or some other type of breast cancer. They're going to be scheduled to see an oncologist within a very few days. And they have to be educated enough to get into a good, valuable discussion with their oncologist to determine what their plan is going to be. And so one of the problems with this is they may get the idea of the cure rate. They may say to the oncologist, oh, I don't want to get treated with chemo and radiation because I had this relative that had this horrible, horrible experience, and I don't want to go through that. I want to go through something. I want to try something else. But the oncologist may say, oh, don't worry. The cure rate is skyrocketing. You have a very high chance of overcoming this using, the chemotherapy and radiation that we're using now. But they need to be aware that when somebody quotes the cure rate, they may be quoting a highly inflated number because of those very early stage cancers that would have never developed, and because the DCIS that probably would have never developed into cancer. And what they need to, let me read from an article from David Brownstein. And he's addressing this specific idea, the somewhat deceptive statement about the cure rates. And he says, however, statistics indicate that the age-adjusted death rate for breast cancer is virtually unchanged since 1930.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. You know, some other numbers that kind of go with this is before the widespread use of mammography, there were 4,900 cases of DCIS diagnosed in the U.S. Mm-hmm. In 2002, it had risen to 48,000, and now it's 60,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And really,
that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot of treatment. It's a lot of money. And it's a lot of needless, in most cases, it's not a lot of needless worries. I would say that if a person gets a DCIS diagnosis, they should be aware that it's not really within the definition of cancer, and they should much more strongly consider the approach that I've outlined at the beginning of the show, the vitamin D, the iodine, the selenium, maybe with the vitamin C, the zinc, the vitamin E, as a preventative measure to put them in that category of person where that DCIS never really does develop into a real cancer. Instead of going through, you know, chemical, radiation, biopsy, surgery, etc., or even in some cases, you know, preventative mastectomy, you know, the most radical of all. And right now, I think we're going to go to another break, and we'll be back for the final segment in a few minutes. Green. This is Daniel Cobb, Dr. of Oriental Medicine, back with my radio show, Natural Medicine. And the call-in phone number is 505-424-4550. And we love call-in questions. Now, Karen, you had another thing you found over the break.
Oh, yeah, something else in this article. Just, again, talking about DCIS, that Dr. Laura Esserman, professor of surgery and radiology at University of California, San Francisco, is heading a campaign for radical change to the way DCIS is seen and treated. And one of the keys, she believes, is renaming the condition and removing the term carcinoma from the title. So there, you know, this isn't just something that alternative people like Dr. Cobb are talking about. This is something that statisticians are looking at in terms of cancer rates and screening. This is, you know, there are a lot of medical professionals out there, you know, who are well aware of this. It's just that the news doesn't get reported, you know, and one of the things that, you know, it's really easy to see why. When you realize that most of these machines are made by General Electric, and when you turn on Channel 4 and you watch a Today show and they have someone there talking about different things, they're never going to say anything that would hurt their sponsor, which is GE. And just one of the things I found out not too long ago is even the chime, NBC, is the letters on a piano are GEC, quite deliberately, which means General Electric Company. So from NBC's inception, General Electric was their sponsor. So, but just to, you know, when we have business so tied to the news, this kind of information is just really hard to get out.
Mm-hmm. And there's no one that's going to pay advertising to say, you know, vitamin D, which costs pennies a day, selenium, pennies a day, iodine, adequate doses of iodine, pennies a day. Who's going to pay, you know, a couple $100,000 for a 1 minute advertisement? The money isn't there. People have to figure out this pretty much on their own.
Yeah. So the fact that we have for-profit news is sort of a big problem in really getting information.
Yeah. Now, the next thing I want to do is I want to read some. I actually got some quotes from the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, on the major nutrients that I'm that I'm promoting as preventative for cancer, for breast cancer, vitamin D. And this, I'm not paraphrasing, I'm quoting directly. The possible link between vitamin D and breast cancer is under active study. Most of the vitamin D a person gets comes from the sun, and a small amount comes from diet. Some studies have found that vitamin D exposure through diet alone or diet plus sunlight lowers breast cancer risk. Other studies, including a meta-analysis of six studies, have found no link between vitamin D and breast cancer risk. Further study is needed to know whether vitamin D affects breast cancer risk. This is an absurd statement.
Where is that from?
This is from the Susan G. Komen Foundation's website.
So they must have thought it was important enough to at least address it, right?
Right, right. But if anybody gets on the internet, when I was writing, I have an article in front of me that I wrote about a year, year and a half ago, and I actually did a link, you know, did a search for breast cancer, vitamin D prevents breast cancer, okay? And I got about 38 million hits. Okay,
wow.
I'd promise I didn't read them all, okay? But where there's smoke, there's fire. If you had 38 million articles or links to articles that are saying, okay, yeah, vitamin D does prevent breast cancer, there's something there. And I'm just quoting a few here on the show, but there's many, many more. There's hundreds of articles and studies that connect vitamin D to breast cancer. And to come
and
up
that
with
can't
this.
That can't be because it's reported what we were just saying about the news and how you can't get this information. It's not like this is some widespread myth that most people out there know about because they've seen it on TV or something like that. So this has to have the origins of the vitamin D studies have to really come from real scientists really looking at these things.
Yes. And other people, you know, reviewing those same studies and saying, wow, how come nobody's talking about this? But to say further study is needed, I mean, there's literally hundreds of studies, peer-reviewed, accepted, published studies linking all kinds of cancer, but breast cancer is one of the most significant types that's linked to levels of vitamin D. Now, let's go next to the next thing that I'm promoting is the idea that selenium is a generalized cancer preventative nutrient, and let's see what Susan G. Komen has to say about it. Initial studies suggest that low body levels of selenium may be a risk factor for developing cancer, particularly gastrointestinal, gynecological, lung, colorectal, and esophageal cancer. Studies have shown significantly reduced risk of some, but not all, cancers in people taking selenium supplements. Additional research is needed to determine the precise role of selenium in reducing cancer risk.
So if it's some, then do they encourage people to take it?
Well, their summary statement is, well, let's hold off. You know, additional research is needed. That's how they impart the emotional idea of, well, just don't jump in quite yet.
Yeah,
we're
you don't want to do something real scary like take a supplement. Yeah. It would be much better to have surgery or to expose yourself to more radiation. Is that it?
Well, you know, at least they want to keep the idea of these nutritional supplements that are capable of preventing cancer. They want to keep them at arm's length.
Well, it seems that way. I guess
okay.
We can't say for sure because they're not here to talk about it, right?
Right. Well, I tried to get them, but couldn't do it. Now, the third one, which in my opinion is probably the strongest for the prevention of breast cancer, is iodine. And I looked through their site, and there was no mention of iodine. As if, well, there's no relationship. There's not even a theoretical, you know, study basis for even mentioning iodine. So I was a little stunned at that. I actually have one experience that I can relate here at the end of the show. I've treated several breast cancer patients, mostly after the fact, after they've had breast cancer and been treated. But there was one that was in the process of actually being diagnosed and just, you know, determining what to treat. And she was told that she had two tumors, and one was deeper under more breast tissue, one was more surface. And I advised her to get some Lugol solution and paint the area with the tumors to make sure that they were saturated to the maximum degree with, you know, all the iodine that the breast tissue needed.
So it just is absorbed through your skin.
Absorbed through the skin and, you know, into that area. And so she painted the area with the more surface tumor, because she figured the one that was deeper in, it wouldn't have any effect because it was too deep. Later, she elected for a double mastectomy. And after the mastectomy, the tumors were biopsied. And when the biopsy results came back, they said the one that was deep, that was, they gave her a characteristic of the type of tumor, stage of the tumor it was. But for the other one, they said, oh, you know, that other place that we told you had cancer, it wasn't really cancer. And I didn't really prompt her on this, but afterwards she asked me, is it possible that the iodine killed the cancer in this short a time? And, you know, that's a question I can't give you an answer for without, you know, I can't give you a definite yes or a definite no. But I can give you a definite maybe. Yes, it could have. It's possible that the reason why they called it, cancer in the beginning, and why when it was biopsied it wasn't cancer, was because of the iodine. And that's it for our show. Let me see. If you want to contact me at my clinic, my phone number is 505-424-9527. And if you want to look at my some of my articles, you can do an internet search on Daniel Cobb, D-O-M, possibly also the Wellspring Library. And I'll see you next week on my show, Natural Medicine.
Second opinion never hurts.
Right.